The following is an unrehearsed conversation with Kentucky's current and 57th Lieutenant Governor, Jeanine Hampton. Lieutenant Governor Hampton became the first African-American in Kentucky history to hold statewide office and the fourth woman to serve as Lieutenant Governor. This interview is being recorded for the Kentucky Oral History Commission and is being conducted by Jordan Smith, Kentucky Oral History Commission member and Government Relations Director at Murray State University. This is being recorded on May 17th, 2018 in Russellville, Kentucky at 188 Earl Davis Drive. Okay, first of all, let me just say thank you, Lieutenant Governor Hampton, for agreeing to do this interview. You are now and will forevermore be a part of Kentucky's rich political history, and frankly, what you have to say matters and should be preserved for the future of our Commonwealth. So the way this will work is I will just ask a series of questions, and from there we can jump topics or go wherever you would like with this.
Okay.
The goal here is not to have a formal interview, but a conversation that can be preserved for the future of Kentucky to gain insights into our Commonwealth's current Lieutenant Governor.
Okay.
So let me just start out with the basics. Where were you born, and what was the path that brought you to the highest of heights in Kentucky government and politics?
Well, I was actually born in Detroit, Michigan, in 1958, and in fact, I just turned 60.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. And my path to Kentucky was a circuitous route through the United States. After I earned my industrial engineering degree at Wayne State University in Detroit, I joined the Air Force. And I served for 7 years. I was stationed during that time in Texas and Oklahoma. And when I got out of the Air Force, I began what became a 19-year career in the corrugated packaging industry, or to the layperson, cardboard boxes. Didn't plan on doing that, but when I got out in 1992, several companies were looking for military officers. They had such good luck with military officers, and it was a wide range of companies. And I interviewed with Packaging Corporation of America up in Syracuse, New York. It sounded intriguing. I loved manufacturing, and that's what got me up to New York, upstate New York, and I was there for a while. And did various jobs and ended up in sales, however, which gave me the flexibility of going back to school. And the year that I earned my MBA from the University of Rochester in 2003, I got a job offer from Weyerhaeuser at the time in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
I had never been to Bowling Green, never even driven through Kentucky, but loved what we researched. My husband and I researched Kentucky. Bowling Green in particular, loved everything we saw about it. The cost of living was low. It was beautiful, beautiful green spaces. And I interviewed, came down, and I got the job, and that's what got me to Kentucky.
Great, great. Well, I know your mother, Miss Marie, you've said, is such an important force in your life.
She is.
What did you learn from her that made you the person and leader you are today, do you think?
Oh, wow. First of all, my mom is 90, and she lives with me and my husband in Bowling Green. Very blessed to have her with us. We moved her out of Detroit a few years ago. I've learned a lot from her. You know, she ended up raising me and my three sisters as a single mother after she and my dad divorced when I was young. And she set structure for us. She really did. She didn't get past high school, and so her job options were a little limited, and she struggled. I watched her struggle. But that said, I watched her stretch a dollar. Live on less than you make. You know, Dave Ramsey says that today, but I kind of heard that from my mom first. But she set boundaries for us.
Mm-hmm.
She set boundaries, and you didn't want to disappoint her. And you knew that the things that she did for us were out of love, and so... That structure that she set was very important. She also took us to church every Sunday. Now, I admit that I kind of shied away from God and church because I had a bad experience.
Mm-hmm.
I overheard some adults making fun of me and my family. This is when I was young, based on what we were wearing. You know, we, like I said, we were poor. Probably had two Sunday dresses that we alternated every other week. And it's one thing when you hear kids mocking you, but when you hear adults mocking you, it's a hard thing. And so I thought, well, if that's what God's all about, if that's what church is all about, I don't want anything to do with it. However, I clearly missed the lesson. I've learned that. But I also realized in hindsight that my mother prayed for me.
Wow.
And my sisters, when I didn't have enough faith to pray for myself. I realized that. When I was cleaning out my very first car, it was a Dodge Omni, 1978 Dodge Omni. I drove it till the wheels fell off. It was sitting in my mom's driveway, rusting out. And this is when I was in the military, and I was going to sell it to somebody for parts. And I was cleaning it out, and I found in there a cross that she had made out of palms that she'd gotten from Palm Sunday. It had been in there for years because it was dried out. It was very small, maybe about 3 inches high or so. And she had fashioned this cross and sneaked it in my car. I didn't even know it was in there. And she prayed for me when I didn't have enough faith to pray for myself. And so she's still a blessing. She's still a blessing in my life.
I think it's safe to say that you're probably Lieutenant Governor because of your mother.
Absolutely.
You know?
She's definitely part of the story. She is absolutely, definitely part of the story.
That is really neat. I love seeing photos of her that you've shared with me.
And yes.
I hope to meet her one day. That's a great story.
Well, you know, and on Inauguration Day, I was so proud. You know, she's sitting there. And I got to thank her for what she did. And if you watch the video of the inauguration, they put the camera on her when I mentioned her. And she just looks so cute. She's all bundled up. It was a little cool.
That was a cold day.
But just to get to thank her in such a public forum was just so rewarding.
I bet. That is so neat. So, well, let's talk a little bit about this passion you have for manufacturing. You know, I've had the good fortune of touring Briggs & Stratton with you and Murray, and witnessed your just total excitement and joy at being around manufacturing industries. And you mentioned that you worked for 25 years in the automotive and packaging industries. Mm-hmm. But where do you think this interest in manufacturing really stems from?
Well, I can go back to my childhood, actually, and recall the times that one of my favorite activities was taking things apart and putting them back together again. I'd love to know how things work. And today, even today, when I visit a classroom, I'll often ask the question, I'll ask the kids, how many of you love to take things apart and put them back together? And I tell them, you are potential engineers, because that's clearly where I was headed. And so I think it goes back then. And then, of course, my dad kind of nurtured that a little bit. I used to watch him repair TV sets. I'd be right there looking over his shoulder. And then later, when I got my first car, he and I would work on it together. He taught me basic auto mechanics, auto repair, and then some. But he had so much trouble with the car, we did a lot. I changed the head gasket. We changed steering rods. We changed the flywheel. We did a number of things on that car. But he'd come over, we'd put it up on the jack, and we'd work on it right there in the driveway. So, but I love to see how things are made, and going to college right there in Detroit at Wayne State University. When I was in engineering school, we visited several companies, several plants that were in the area. A lot of auto plants. Actually, I worked for General Motors on my way, working my way through school. But we visited auto plants. We visited some of the other feeder companies that feed the auto industry. Mm-hmm. And so I just have a love of manufacturing and seeing how things are made. And when you're in sales, I learned, you have an opportunity to see other manufacturing plants. So it's one of the reasons that I stayed in sales, even though I planned for that only to be a temporary stop in my corrugated packaging career.
Well, I know you've been a champion of manufacturing, as has Governor Bevin. So I think it's going to be interesting for folks to hear kind of where that passion started. Let's talk a little bit about the 2015 gubernatorial campaign. So your ease on the campaign trail was evident to myself and many others throughout the entire race. Obviously so, you and Governor Bevin won the race with 52.5% of the vote. So it's clear to most everyone that you do truly have a gift for retail politics. Where does that talent for campaigning come from?
You know, I'm really not sure. You know, this is the first elected office I've ever held. That's same with Governor Bevin. But the first time I ever ran for office was in 2014. I ran for the Kentucky State House in Bowling Green, unsuccessfully, but I learned a lot. And I don't know that there's a talent, but what I do have is a passion for wanting to make Kentucky better. And that was part of the reason that I ran for the State House in 2014. You know, I'd never run for anything. I had helped someone on a campaign. I had attended the Commonwealth Policy Center's candidate training course with the intent of helping other candidates. And through my Tea Party activity in Bowling Green, I started paying attention to what was going on in Frankfort and not being very happy about it. You know, sometimes when you say someone should do something, there's a problem, someone should do something, sometimes that someone is you. And so I just decided to jump in. I love the idea of we the people, government of, by, and for the people. And the people is us, that's me. Even though I don't come from a political family, no one in my family had ever run for office, no one really even talks politics in my family. But I just had a passion for wanting to make things better. Mm-hmm. I think that's actually a hallmark of my undergrad degree, my industrial engineering degree. That's what industrial engineers do, is process improvement. And anything is a process. Any and everything can be defined as a process. Same with government. And I just couldn't stay on the sidelines. I just couldn't. I didn't see enough of the problems, Kentucky's problems, being addressed adequately, I thought. And it was actually through my Tea Party activities that I actually met Matt Bevin for the first time. We vetted him when he ran for the Senate. Mm-hmm. Our group vetted him, and I was still, though, you know, we got to be friends after he lost his race. Mm-hmm. And I was still stunned when, after I lost my House race, he told me he was running for governor and asked me to be his running mate.
Well, we're certainly glad he did. A lot of articles have, as you know, have been written about particularly that 2015 governor's race. Mm-hmm. And many have kind of pointed to that election as kind of that kind of anti-establishment, anti-political class fever that did elect you and Matt Bevin was somewhat of a precursor to the Trump election in 2016. What are your thoughts on when people want to draw that line?
I'm not sure that it was an anti-establishment vote necessarily. Mm-hmm. My viewpoint from the campaign trail, and we were all over Kentucky. I drove 50,000 miles. I went back and added up my expense reports, the mileage on my expense reports. But I think what I saw as I traveled Kentucky, I think people were hungry for real solutions. Mm-hmm. And I think they just wanted to be told the truth, good or bad. Just tell us the truth. And I think that's what they responded to. Governor Bevin tells the truth. And sometimes when you hear the truth, it's not what you really want to hear. But I think my sense is that people had gotten fed up with the so-called career politicians who parse their words and maybe they don't really pursue the hard solutions because it won't get them reelected. I think people were tired of that. I think they just wanted things better, and they wanted people who would be willing to come in and take on the hard solutions. That's the sense that I got as we traveled Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. Well, and knowing your personality, I know even now you wouldn't consider yourself part of any kind of permanent political class or anything like that.
Not at all.
You may not have thought about or think about things like what your legacy is, but you do have one, and you continue to make a huge imprint on our state. So what do you see as your legacy in Kentucky? What contributions do you hope to be remembered for?
Well, I know that I get once in a while I'll get feedback from either parents or sometimes students or teachers. I've actually been in over 130 schools. Teachers have, maybe someone heard me speak somewhere at a Rotary Club or something, and I typically will talk about my life growing up in Detroit, and they'll ask me to come and share my life story with the students. They think there's a lot of lessons there. Mm-hmm. And as I get feedback, they'll tell me what students see. They'll say, well, you know what, I can do this. I don't grow up rich either. They tend to connect. I grew up poor. I grew up poor in Detroit. I'm black. And you know, there's all these sometimes excuses you hear for why or how you can't, as the reason you cannot excel. And I fly in the face of all of that. Even though we were poor, we didn't have a lot of things, didn't have a car, washing machines, and some years not even a TV set. None of that seemed to matter. I still excelled in school. School's free. And I loved school, loved reading, and even when I got to college, started out with a small scholarship, but really had to work my way through college. There's always a way to get there, mm-hmm. But you have to. Sometimes you have to work for it. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's not easy, and students get to see this. When they're asking me, questions about various parts of my life, you know, they depending on the age group, they'll ask, you know, about the things I did as a kid, how did I get there? That's what they're interested in, and as I share my story, I see the interest. I see these kids. The light goes on, and they go, and they think they believe that things are possible. Now there are things possible. Young ladies, for example, are still, in this day and age, in 2018, young ladies are still shying away from science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM, the so-called mm-hmm. STEM fields. And when I go in and talk about these things, and the light goes on, and they think, I can do this. I can at least try it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's my legacy. I think that will be my legacy, because I'm hearing from some parents that I am inspiring their kids. I think the ultimate compliment, my chief of staff told me, he got feedback from a parent. The little boy wants to be the lieutenant governor. And the dad said, well, you know, you can be the governor or even the president. He says, no, I want to be the lieutenant governor. So, you know, if I am inspiring Kentucky's kids to see beyond their circumstances mm-hmm. and believe they're not stuck there, if I can leave that legacy, then this has all been worth it.
Mm-hmm. And that definitely would be a great legacy to leave. And I know you've spoken at Murray State University before, mm-hmm. and I've heard similar feedback about, you know, man, her work ethic is so inspiring, and her story about education and service in the military is mm-hmm. so inspiring. And I think that is going to be one of your many legacies you leave to Kentucky. So final question, as you know, 2020 is the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment mm-hmm. to the Constitution, which gave women the right to vote, mm-hmm. as you know. What are your thoughts on this upcoming anniversary and the impact that women continue to make, both in Kentucky politics and nationally?
Well, you know, I'm still stunned that not everybody votes. Not every eligible voter votes, and that includes some women in there. I grew up with an appreciation of the United States of America. I knew by the time I was 10 or 12 that I was blessed to be born in this nation, in the United States of America. I knew that I had rights that I maybe necessarily wouldn't have had if I lived in another nation. And the fact that I can vote here, it's interesting, during Desert Storm, I was stationed in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, a country where women not only can't vote, they can't even drive. And so I just have a unique appreciation for our form of government. And I saw this when I was running for the State House. You know, you have access to the voter data. You could see who voted in the last five election cycles, primary and the general election. And there's you know, the registration is very low in Kentucky, as it is in most places, and the turnout is low. And I just don't understand that, because our ability to vote and shape our government is so sacred. And again, there's women. There were women on that list who maybe they didn't understand that it wasn't that long ago where they were not even allowed to vote. It wasn't that long ago where black people were not even allowed to vote. And so I hold these things precious, and so I celebrate this amendment. And again, I celebrate the form of government that we have. The government here is just it's so generous that we are allowed to participate as much as we want to in our form of government. And many people choose not to do the basic thing, which is to just vote, to help elect the leaders who are going to lead their, you know, their city, their county, their nation. It just stuns me so. But I have a unique appreciation for that amendment.
Great. Well, on behalf of the Kentucky Oral History Commission, I want to thank you for taking time to talk with me, and thank you, Lieutenant Governor Hampton, for your service.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.